How many hours of Williams sisters tennis matches, Hillary Clinton stump speeches, Nicki Minaj music videos, and Keeping Up with the Kardashian episodes, among others, did you watch in the name of research for the book?
I spent a very long week watching every episode that Kim was pregnant in, Kim Kardashian was pregnant in, which is more than you would think. It was actually a wonderful week.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend it, especially if you think the Kardashians are stupid, because it'll change your mind about why people watch the show and why people find Kim Kardashian compelling.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with media critic Anne Helen Peterson about her book, Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Reign of the Unruly Woman. Anne works as a senior culture writer at BuzzFeed. You have a PhD in media studies. I want to know, what is it like to sit next to you and watch an episode of Girls or Mike and Molly or Game of Thrones?
Let me backtrack a little. When I was growing up, my mom, who, you know, never called herself a feminist, was absolutely a feminist, would sometimes sit next to me and call my attention to things. Like when we were watching The Little Mermaid, she'd be like, oh, isn't that significant that she lost her voice in order to get a man? Or she wouldn't allow us to watch MTV unless we were sitting there with her. And so I remember watching the Counting Crows video for Mr. Jones. This was like, you know, probably 1994. And there's a woman, and it's just the band playing. And then in the background, there's a woman in a flamenco dress, which is like a lyric in the song. And my mom's saying, like, why is there close-ups of this woman? Why are they objectifying this woman? And I would be like, oh, mom, like, you're the worst. Like, shut up.
Right.
But those moments obviously have stuck with me for some time. But I never do that myself. You know, I don't have kids, but I have been a teacher for a long time. And even when I was a teacher, it wasn't like I was sitting in the audience next to my students like, pause, look at this.
Right.
I think part of being a media critic is teaching yourself to be able to enjoy something, you know, actually take pleasure in watching a television show, reading a book, listening to a song, but then also not shutting off those parts that think critically about it. I think, or I believe pretty fiercely, that analysis doesn't necessarily destroy pleasure. It enriches the pleasure. So I don't talk during it.
Okay.
And I usually don't even talk right after it. I love going to movies by myself for that particular reason, because I love just sitting with my own reaction to the movie for a long time. But I think that I always do want to discuss it in an interesting way, like whether that's an hour from then, whether that's, you know, a week from then, or writing a piece about it.
The book is dedicated to your unruly mother. What other lessons do you think she imparted upon you that led you to write the book?
So part of the book is about how readers can embody unruliness in their own lives. And this is, it's never super explicit. I'm never like, here's the 10 steps to be unruly. You know, I mean, the book explicitly is about celebrities and their unruliness. But what it's doing is inviting readers to think through the lens of these celebrities about unruliness as a concept and in their own lives. And I think that what my mom taught me by her example, growing up in Lewiston, Idaho, which, you know, is a town of 30,000, here's how I'll put it. There are not a lot of ways of being in Lewiston that are acceptable. There's just not a whole huge cornucopia of like, oh, I could be this type of person or this type of person. Like, right. The options that I saw from before me were like, I could be a jock or a cheerleader. I could be straight or straight.
Right.
I could be Christian or Mormon. I mean, I could be Christian like Catholic or Presbyterian,
right.
Or I could be Christian like Mormon. So in my mom, I saw someone who, you know, in some ways she was very ruly in terms of being like a middle class woman who was straight. But then in other ways, like her refusal to wear makeup or like the way that she snorts in public, or she was president of the school board and was pretty fearless in the way that she articulated what she thought about schools and school funding and that sort of thing. I think that I internalized a lot of that.
I want to come back to the arc and structure and subjects of the book. But before that, I just want to stay with your personal story. So will you read us a little section from the book?
Yeah. So I fought not to have this in the book at first. And this is my academic training, which, you know, you very much, you acknowledge your identity, perhaps, and where you're coming from in terms of analysis, but you don't bring a personal biography into it. And so when my editor was like, we need a little personalization, it's fine. But at the same time, I love writing about myself. Like, who doesn't love writing about themselves? So, all right. Someone might look at a picture of me or read my resume and wonder what interest I would have in unruliness. I'm white, I'm blonde, I'm not fat. I grew up middle class in a mid-sized town. I got straight A's. I was a cheerleader for 7 years. The only time I got in trouble in high school was for skipping AP English to go to the premiere of Star Wars. I'm straight and cisgender. I attended a good college and went on to pursue a PhD. I've received one speeding ticket. But so much of that amenability, that need to please, that lack of acting out, stemmed from a posture of fear. My mother was a weirdo, non-makeup-wearing mathematician, so the fear certainly didn't come from her. But I was always cripplingly terrified of what people thought of me. My classmates, the boys I liked and even the ones I didn't, random people on the street, the teachers whose approval I craved. That fear was so overwhelming that I allowed it to temper and otherwise silence the parts of myself that gave me joy. I stopped raising my hand as much in class. I disciplined my body through various forms of overexercise and disordered eating, not because I liked running, but because I was mortified by the thought of getting fat. I didn't believe God would forsake me if I lost my virginity, but I kept it out of anxiety that I'd be labeled a slut. I didn't drink because who knew what embarrassing thing I might say or do while drunk. I was happy ostensibly, but every move was motivated by fear. Part of this fear was derived from living in a rural town where gossip and small-mindedness make other ways of being unthinkable. But part of it was entirely my own devising. I spent the bulk of my adolescent life internalizing the fact that girls who crossed that invisible line would become pariahs. Excised from their communities and families, unable to find work or companionship. I was wrong, of course, but it took finding my own group of weird, confident, too much friends for me to lean into my own difference, my own modes of unruliness. It's taken many years for those behaviors to blossom, and many internal checks remain stubbornly difficult to slough. Just because you spend years analyzing unruliness doesn't mean you're not subject to the trenchant cultural imperative to shun, shame, and reject it. Which is precisely why I wanted to write this book. These unruly women are so magnetic, but that magnetism is countered at every point by ideologies that train both men and women to distance themselves from those behaviors in our own lives. Put differently, it's one thing to admire such abrasiveness and disrespect for the status quo in someone else. It's quite another to take that risk in one's own life.
In what ways have you become more unruly with age?
I was a huge people pleaser growing up, and I think, you know, that I just discussed, and I still crave others' approval, but I think I'm more okay with not always being nice or being perceived as nice. And I think most women are taught that, like, that is your natural mode of being towards the world, right? Mm-hmm. Is that in our emails, in our thank you notes, in our interactions with a grocery store clerk, in everything that we have to be kind, nice, cheery, ebullient. And I'm still really nice to the grocery clerk, like to waiters, like all the people who deserve that sort of treatment. Yeah. And it's much easier out here in the West because they're nice to you back. Right. You know, it's hard. When I lived in New York, you know, they'd have these grocery clerks who'd be like, it'd be almost like they were giving you the middle finger while you checked out. And that's just kind of a way of being, like a way of existing in New York life is like, everything sucks and you do too. And I begrudgingly respect it. But being nice to that felt like you were just a rube from a small town. But I think for me now, like, I don't feel the need as much to always apologize. Like, a new way I've heard of, like, if you're late for a meeting or something like that, instead of saying, like, I'm so sorry and giving an excuse, you're like, thank you for waiting for me, you know? So kind of instead of blaming myself or taking that posture of, like, I'm always messing up and I need to overwhelm you with kindness in order to make up for that, just arriving at this baseline of, like, we both respect each other. Let's start here.
Yeah.
I've also started emailing like a man, which is this tactic that one of my colleagues taught me, which is she did this experiment where she emailed like a man for a week, which is just like one sentence replies.
Yeah.
That are like, fine. Uh-huh. Great. You know, like that sort of thing.
Right.
And it's wonderful.
Is it liberating?
And it's totally liberating. And, you know, like it just takes less time. And I think that maybe there are people out there who are like, oh, she's kind of terse. But if you meet me in person, like I'm not a terse person. And so I think we spend so much time thinking through how our online actions are perceived, and you can't control every part of it. So I try to be as authentic to myself and be careful in places where it matters and try not to care as much in places where it doesn't.
I was thinking about both your decision to leave academia and how that parallels a sense of unruliness. And also, as you become more visible as a critic and as a writer for BuzzFeed, are you thinking about your image as celebrity now?
So the thing about leaving academia is I left, but I also was kicked out in that there wasn't a job. I was a professor for 2 years at Whitman College and was up for a job there and applied for a couple of other jobs and none of them came through. And I was in the position where I had been writing online and I had a book contract for my first book. And I was like, what? So I could either like go live in my mom's basement. Like that was seriously one of my thoughts was like, I don't have a full-time job. So I could go live in my mom's basement and like cobble together some freelance work and do that and go on the market again as an academic and try this again. Or I could just stop being an academic, you know, not forget all of these incredible ideas and experiences that I had had over the course of my PhD and use them, but stop trying to play a game where I wasn't wanted. And it's not, when I say I wasn't wanted, it means like the dynamics of the job market right now are such that like there just isn't space enough for all the people who are deserving of jobs. But the thing I did that was unruly is that I talked about why I left. And I did it pretty prominently. And there are probably some things that looking back that I could have worded differently. But I think there's value in that unruliness, that brashness. And there have been a lot of people who have emailed and thanked me. I lost some friendships over it. But I think that having someone speak jagged truths about the job market in academia, the brokenness of academia, is really important. And I'm glad that I was able to be part of that conversation that is still very much ongoing. Mm-hmm. And then the second question, which is about my own celebrity. You know, I think that the only people who realize they're celebrities are people who like very, very suddenly go from no one knowing who they are to like everyone knowing who they are, or, you know, from being like on the cover of a magazine. So someone like Jennifer Lawrence, whose ascension was very, very swift. Whereas people who are just like writers who some people know who they are,
right.
You know, or like that I have met some famous people, because sometimes that means fame, right? Is like proximity to famous people, that I have like profiled some famous people, that like Lorde, the singer, for whatever reason, started following me several years ago and DM'd me the other night with a question about classic Hollywood. Like, we're not friends.
Right.
Like, she just had, like, an open avenue to ask me a question about whether Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart ever had beef. That doesn't mean that I'm famous. It means that I'm more visible, I think.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Anne Helen Peterson about her book, Too Fat,
Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Reign of the Unruly Woman. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, Anne will address the mythology of the West in popular media.
So you begin the book by talking about the whiteness of tennis and the Williams sisters, specifically Serena. And I'm curious, how did you select the subjects for the book?
So the book was kind of reverse engineered. After my first book came out, I met with my agent and my editor to come up with, okay, so what are we going to write about next? And I didn't have any ideas like right away. More, it was like, who are the women that we are really interested in right now who are super compelling? And we made up a list of like the people at that point. And this was probably 2015. And then I took that list home and was like, okay, what's the unifying factor here? And it was their unruliness. And I had written a little bit about unruliness and the Broad City Girls when I first wrote about their show when it came out. So I had some of that framework. And this book is built on the shoulders of the book of one of my mentors, Kathleen Rowe Carlin, who is a professor at University of Oregon, who wrote about, like, her book is called The Unruly Woman, mm-hmm. and it's about Roseanne uh-huh. in the 90s. And so I was like, oh, I could apply that framework to this next generation of unruliness. And so how is it working in this kind of post-feminist mm-hmm. but embrace of feminism? Like, what's going on there? And so we came up with this idea of, like, two whatever and thought, okay, so what are the different celebrities? So some of them right away were like, okay, Lena Dunham. And at first she was going to just be too much. Uh-huh. But then we narrowed that down to too naked. Uh-huh. And then some of them were like, okay, so we want to do someone who's too queer. Who should that be?
Yeah.
And there were some people like Leah Deloria, who's from Orange is the New Black, who would be fascinating to write about. But she's actually too queer to be within the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And so I purposely was choosing people who were in the mainstream and navigating that line of unruliness that allowed them to still be like very consumable from a pop culture standpoint. Because I didn't necessarily want to look at these women who were rejected by society, but what does it mean to like play with unruliness, to have unruly components of yourself, mm-hmm. to use unruliness as a marketing tool, mm-hmm. to just, you know, straddle that line. Mm-hmm. So that's why I chose someone like Caitlyn Jenner, who is a very complicated and largely unlikable figure.
Yeah.
And who was harder to write about, frankly, and harder for people to read about. But at the same time, that challenge was really rewarding.
Right. And you use this term transnormativity. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
So transnormativity is a long word that Microsoft Word does not like, not because it's transphobic, but because it's an academic word. And I borrow it from trans scholarship. And what it means is hewing to this very normative idea of what a trans person would look like, would act like, what their trans coming out story would be like, mm-hmm. and also trying to erase their trans status. And what I mean by that is that someone like Caitlyn Jenner is very fixated on people not being able to tell that she is trans. So erasing the signs of transition in all ways, whether that's through surgeries, through voice, through just the way that you talk about yourself. Mm-hmm. And whereas some people within the trans community are very much like, I am proudly trans. Like, I do not hew to these understandings. And like, transnormativity, it's just trying to be cisgender.
Yeah.
And I am a trans person, not a cis person. That chapter goes deep on that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the use of that word transnormative, but I think it's a really useful one.
Yeah, it was an important word for me to learn. At the end of the book, you refer to the book both as a celebration and as a warning. And I'm wondering if you can just distill that warning that we are now maybe seeing today, or to talk about the ways that we might become complicit in preventing unruliness or silencing it.
Yeah. I think that the history of feminism is two steps forward, one step back, always, right? But that still means one step forward. And what we're in the midst of at this moment, or even I would say a year ago, is we're in the midst of that step back. Mm-hmm. And so our task as women, as feminists, as people who aren't women but who are feminists, is to make that step smaller. And in order to do so, you have to see the mechanisms of the backlash at work. And I think this is particularly true of something like Me Too, when you watch people saying like, well, this is now a witch hunt. I can't, is it not okay for me to hug anyone ever again? You know, instead of buying into those reactionary logics, really pushing back against that tendency to be like, we've gone too far.
Right.
Right. Like, obviously, we need to be incredibly careful with the way that each accusation is treated. We have to be mindful of our own, you know, the way that we articulate believing women, the way that feminism intersects with all of this, like all of this stuff. Like, you just need to be thoughtful about it and not react from our gut, which can sometimes look like saying things like it is a witch hunt or it's gone too far, or maybe we should like pause and time out and like stop all of this. Or another thing that I've seen with the women's movement in general, especially from white women, is a recoil from suggestions or complaints or arguments from people who aren't middle class or white or straight or cisgender about how, like, you know, things like the Women's March have taken form and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the thing I've said over and over again is, like, it's not that this new women's movement is fractured.
Right.
It's that it's complicated. Mm-hmm. And that complication is it's incredible. It's so valuable. And, like, those points of friction are all learning points. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that means, like, for white women in particular, white middle-class women, is listening more. Yeah. And so, you know, like, white middle-class women are some of the biggest buyers of books, and they are right. Some of the biggest buyers of this book. Yeah. And hopefully one of the things that we can take home and that I am trying to internalize as well is, like, what does it look like to listen? Mm-hmm. What does it look like to be silent? Like, obviously unruliness sounds like it's the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. But if you are trying to be part of a larger movement, mm-hmm. that is truly intersectional, then maybe that also means knowing when to shut up.
When to step back.
Yeah. Like, can shutting up be an act of unruliness? Yeah, kind of. Or, right. You know.
Or making space. Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You did one of these beautifully long and complex analyses of Justin Timberlake's new album, Man of the Woods.
And if you can't even say Man of the Woods without
crying. I can't, because I have the image of the cover in my head. But I know that you're originally from Idaho, so you're familiar with the West. The West is maybe in your bones. And in this article that you write about Justin, you talk about the fetishization of the West. And I want to ask you first, what do you mean by that?
So the fetishization of the West, I always think of, and I think people from Montana can understand, you know, it's the dude. Like, I worked at a dude ranch after I graduated from college, and it's the person who has this image of the West that is still very much the Charlie Russell inspired, mm-hmm. maybe John Wayne inflected, mm-hmm. River runs through it, you know, kind of peppered on top vision of what the West is like, which is a wide open space where men can be men. And contingent upon that understanding is, or, you know, implicit to that understanding is, like, where white men can be masculine men.
Right.
And I think that I've always known about this myth of the West, and, like, one of the first film classes I ever took as an undergrad was about the Western and learning about the evolution of the Western over the course of the 19th and 20th century, both in literature and in film, and, you know, how things like Turner's thesis, which was like the West is closed, there's no more land, what are we going to do, how that affected our understanding of the West. So I've intellectualized it, but at the same time, coming from Idaho and then moving away from there to New York and to other places not from the West, and observing how people talk about the West and think about the West really drove that home. And then also, since moving back to Missoula this past year explicitly to serve as Western correspondent, you know, watching how people react to and how Montana specifically lives in the mind of the world is so fascinating. When you talk to someone, whether they're a Trump voter or not a Trump voter, about Montana, it lives in their imaginations in this way that is incredibly appealing, incredibly magnetic. And Idaho and Wyoming and Nevada, Utah, like, they do not live in people's imaginations those ways. Like, they make – so when I tell people on the left that I live in Montana, they think it's amazing. When I tell people on the right that I live in Montana, they also think it's amazing and, like, authenticates me in some way. That I know who they are, even if they're from, like, Ohio. So I think that that's a very long way of answering the ways that I've thought about the West and the way that it is fetishized and over the history, like over the last 300 years, but then also in our contemporary moment.
And I really want to know, what's your vision? You know, if we were to apply this unruly framework to the West, to the mythology of the West, what could that look like? You know, for women or intersectional feminism, like, how could we disrupt that?
I think part of it is even, you know, what I said in the intro to my book and talking about myself and offering different ways of being for people who live in these spaces, because there aren't a ton of super strong female role models. Like in Montana, you know, everyone talks about Jeanette Rankin.
Right.
Without mentioning the fact that, like, oh, it's essentially impossible to be elected to one of the higher offices in Montana politics if you're a woman. Or that, like, there are some incredible models of, like, potential female leaders who just get, like, drubbed in the polls. And I see that also in places, like, one of my favorite parts of covering the Montana special election was I went to Great Falls, which totally underrated Montana City, and I know that people in Great Falls feel the same. And the Indivisible group there, which is called Great Falls Rising, they're like, these are women, you know, who have never been organizers in their life and, like, came together and have decided to put themselves out there. Like, and a lot of them are, you know, over the age of 50 or 60. They're like, I don't care what anyone thinks of me. I'm going to fight for what I believe in and try to make life better for other people. And sometimes that's not easy in a place like Great Falls, but are doing that work. And, you know, that's not just in Great Falls, that's in communities all over the Mountain West.
Anne Helen Peterson recently returned to the Rocky Mountain West. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org. where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.